I think we'll begin. Now, I want to welcome all of you here today. My name is Tom Berger, and I'm chairman of the Alaska Native Review Commission. We are engaged in 3 weeks of what we have called overview roundtable discussions. This has been an attempt over 3 weeks to look at the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act of 1971, to analyze it, and to consider as well the measures taken by Native Americans in the lower 48 regarding Native land, ancestral lands, and self-rule, self-government. And this week, the third week, we're looking at what measures have been taken in other countries besides the United States, what measures have been taken in Canada, in Greenland, in Australia, in Norway, to protect and preserve Native ancestral lands, and what measures have been taken to enable Native people, Aboriginal people, to govern the things that matter most to them in their own lives. And those questions fall broadly, I suppose, under the general heading of Native land and governance. After these overview roundtable discussions are over, the Commission will be going to villages throughout Alaska to hear the views of Alaska Natives about the land claim settlement enacted by Congress for the Native people of this state back in 1971. And then next year, the Commission will write a report that will assist Alaska Natives in determining what directions they want to take, where they want to go, and will indicate how far from their point of view and how well the settlement enacted by Congress in 1971 has worked out. So I should, before going any farther, say that the overview roundtable discussions that have been taking place here for 3 weeks are sponsored not only by the Commission but by the Humanities Forum of Alaska. And I want to thank Chris Cook, who has served as chairman of the Humanities Forum of Alaska, and the current chairman of the Humanities Forum, Ron Scullin, and as well Gary Holthaus, the executive director. They have worked with us in bringing all of you together, and we are grateful to the Humanities Forum. All that we say here today is being recorded by sound, and a transcript is being prepared that will be available. The transcripts from the first week are already available, and we expect that they will continue to be produced on schedule. And the proceedings are as well being filmed in toto. I think I should just tell you we have already put in 2 weeks here of discussions. I might just review the purport of those discussions for a few minutes, because some of you only arrived this morning, and it may be useful to you to know what we've been talking about here. This commission was established to review the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act of 1971, which is known as ANCSA. And if we refer to it as ANCSA, we'll all know what we're talking about. It was the first great land claim settlement in the modern era, And under that settlement, $962.5 million was paid to Alaska Natives, and 44 million acres of land was to be conveyed to them. The 44 million acres constitutes approximately 10% of the land of the state of Alaska. Now, we had here 2 weeks ago Native leaders who negotiated that settlement. They said that it wasn't a matter of being granted 44 million acres, that the whole state belonged to the Native people, and that it was a question of working out a fair accommodation, of ensuring that they held, by fee simple, as much real estate as they could obtain in the settlement. And 44 million acres was obtained. The Native leaders who negotiated that settlement back in the late 60s and early 70s said it was a real estate transaction. Their object was to secure as much land for their people as they could, and 44 million acres was obtained. The $962.5 million was essentially compensation for the loss of the remainder of the land comprising the state of Alaska. The money and the land was turned over to Native corporations. There are 200 villages in Alaska, Native villages, 200 of them. Each village was made a village corporation and allowed to select lands in the vicinity of the village. Those lands are held in fee simple. There are as well 12 regional corporations cover the 12 principal regions of Alaska, and these regional corporations made land selections. The regional corporations as well hold all the subsurface resources on village lands as well as the regional corporation lands. So that the land and the money was turned over to the corporations. Now, the corporations have held that land for 12 years, and the corporations have used the money very largely to invest in resource development in Alaska, and it has been invested in projects such as hotels here in Anchorage, and the corporate structures established under the Act have given Alaska Natives economic influence and some measure of political influence as well. Now, I should say that we have already begun the village meetings in this state, and that the two held in February at Monick and Tununuk, a good deal of dissatisfaction with the land claim settlement was expressed by people living in those villages. They felt that they had seen little or nothing in the way of benefits from the Act. Indeed, they found that they were obliged to pay the regional corporation in the area a fee for subsurface resources such as coal that in the past they had simply taken freely from what they considered to be their ancestral lands. Corporation presidents have testified here, and they have expressed a certain measure of dissatisfaction with the statute. Byron Malott, the president of Sea Alaska Corporation, the largest of the regional corporations, it's pointed out that the corporations have to make a profit, and thus they regard the lands they hold as economic assets, and yet the people in the state, the Native people, largely regard those lands as ancestral lands that ought to be preserved forever for subsistence hunting and fishing and trapping. And Mr. Malott pointed out the dilemma that that places the corporations in. The corporations are shareholders' corporations. That is, every Alaska Native received shares in the regional corporations and the village corporations. Only Native people can hold shares, but in 1991, the shares can be transferred to non-Natives. So there is certainly, I think, among Alaska Natives, a very real concern that in 1991, when the shares become transferable, their corporations will become subject to takeover bids by non-Native interests, and that the corporations could be lost to Native control and the land lost with the corporations. We have had at these hearings the president of the Alaska Federation of Natives, which is an organization that represents the corporations. Mr. Charles Johnson. He has said that the corporations, if they manage their assets astutely, can continue to offer adequate representation for all interests of Alaska Natives. We have had with us Mr. Sheldon Kachetag, who is Vice President of the United Tribes of Alaska. He urged on behalf of his organization that the time had come to restore tribal government and to turn all Native ancestral lands in Alaska over to the tribal governments. They're some of them traditional councils. They are some of them tribal governments established under United States federal legislation. Well, that's a very rough and incomplete picture of what has been said here. For the last 2 weeks, we had Native leaders and lawyers and scholars from the lower 48 here last week, and they spoke of the developments in the lower 48 in the last decade, in which Congress and the Supreme Court of the United States have, in a number of ways, strengthened tribal government in the lower 48. The congressional legislation relating to Indian education and Indian child welfare has given larger powers to tribal governments in the lower 48. Congress has recognized the principle of self-determination in those statutes. The Supreme Court of the U.S. has confirmed the power of tribal governments in the lower 48 to decide who and who is not a member of a tribal government, to decide questions of uses of water, building regulations, zoning on reservation land, has confirmed the right of tribal governments to tax native and non-native interests on tribal lands. Professor Ralph Johnson of the University of Washington told us that there has been a very significant measure of additional power possessed by tribal governments acknowledged in this last 10 years. The theory of tribal sovereignty, I think, that has arisen in all of these countries is largely based on the judgments of Chief Justice Marshall in the United States Supreme Court in the 19th century, who said that Indian nations in the U.S. were domestic dependent nations with limited sovereignty. That theory has been, and in many ways, the basis for the assertion of Native claims to self-determination, not only in the United States, but in Canada, and I think in other countries as well. Now we have all of you here, and indeed I am glad that we are all here. And let me just read the list of those who are with us this morning. From Australia, we have Shorty O'Neill of the Federation of Land Councils of Australia, Stanley Scrutton, Chairman of the Central Land Council, Alice Springs, Northern Territory, and Maureen Kelly of the Pilbara Land Council, Marble Bar, Western Australia. From Canada, we have, and I hope I'm right in saying this, Randy Ames. You've got Des Bryce Bennett's name card, but we won't let that fool us. Randy Ames is Research Director of the Tungavik Federation of Nunavut. Desmond Bryce Bennett is Project Manager of the Nunavut Constitutional Forum. Gina Blondin is here. I saw her, I believe. She is here, I think. And she is Assistant to the Minister of Aboriginal Rights, the Government of the Northwest Territories. The Honorable Dennis Patterson is with us. He is the Minister for Aboriginal Rights and Constitutional Development of the Government of the Northwest Territories. The Honorable Peter Tinoir is with us. He is a Member of Parliament from Canada and will be speaking on behalf of the Nunavut Forum. We have Mike Smith from the Yukon, and Glenn Grady from the Yukon, who have both been active in the negotiations that have recently led to an agreement between the Government of Canada and the Council of Yukon Indians for a settlement of their land claims. We have, as well, Letha McLaughlin, who is legal counsel to the Dene Nation, Sam Silverstone, who is legal counsel to Makovic Corporation, Rick Hardy, who is legal counsel to the Métis Association of the Northwest Territories, Bill Erasmus, who is on the Joint Land Claims Negotiating Committee on behalf of the Dene Nation and the Métis Association of the Northwest Territories, and Dwight Noseworthy, who is on the Executive Secretary of the Aboriginal Rights Secretariat of the Northwest Territorial Government. And I think that completes the references to all of the Canadians, except for Mark Gordon, who is about to take his seat, who is Vice President of the Inuit Circumpolar Conference for Canada and Vice President as well of Makovic Corporation. We have, in addition, Robert Peterson from Greenland. Robert Peterson is the director of the Inuit Institute of Eskimology in Nuuk, Greenland, formerly professor of linguistics at the Institute of Eskimology, the University of Copenhagen, Denmark. And we are pleased as well to have with us Alf Isaac Keskitalo of the Sami Institute at Kautokeino in Norway. We have as well David Case seated to my right, who is a professor at the University of Alaska and author of the leading work on the rights of the native people of Alaska and special counsel and legal advisor to this commission. And as well, Rosita Worrell and Chuck Smythe, both anthropologists here in Alaska who are working with the commission, will be participating in the roundtable. I think that the only other person that I need to mention and to thank him is Professor Douglas Sanders of the University of British Columbia at Vancouver, legal counsel to the World Council of Indigenous People, who led off our discussions yesterday with a discussion paper that all of you have, I think, had an opportunity to see. Before we go any farther, let me just tell you what I hope we can get out of these 4 days of, almost 4 days of discussions. We intend to carry on today and tomorrow and Friday. And I would like you to consider some of the things I'm about to mention now, as well as, of course, those things that you came to discuss. Let me just say that we have been reminded here at this roundtable by non-Native participants that in the United States, and I think this is so in Canada and in all of the countries from which we come, there is a large body of opinion that looks with disfavor on the idea that Native people should have their own governments, their own land free from taxation, their own corporations. They are opposed to what they regard as the idea of a nation within a nation, a state within a state. They say that all should have equal rights, and that these rights can be claimed only by individuals, not by Native tribal organizations, not by Native nations, and not by Native people in a collective sense, not as a class. They say that only as individuals can Native people claim rights within the nations where they live. And some say that Native people can no more claim rights belonging to them and to no one else than the Irish in America, or the Italians, the Ukrainians, or the Chinese in America, Australia, Norway, wherever. They say that none of these other people claim the right to their to self-government, and they don't claim their own land should be free from taxation, They don't insist they have corporations in which shares can only be held by native people. Well, this reflects a widely held view that uniformity in language, customs, religion, and culture is good, and that diversity is bad, and that our institutions should be colorblind and should not recognize any of these claims to land or to self-rule within the nation state. Well, you might, as we go along over the next 3 days, let us know to what extent you have encountered this view. It is a view that has been expressed here in Alaska. And what arguments have been advanced on the one side and the other. We want, finally, to know, and most important of all, to know what arrangements you have made for the preservation of ancestral lands in your countries, for the preservation and protection of native ancestral lands. Are those lands held in trust by your national government for the benefit of native people? Are those lands held by native corporations? If you have native corporations, or if you are setting them up under your current land claims proposals, are those native corporations shareholders' corporations in which people hold shares that can be transferred? Well, that's... Well, I hope not. Or are the corporations that you have or that you intend to set up membership corporations in which every person who is entitled to membership in the tribe or the class participates? And what about political institutions? Are the political institutions that you have set up or that you propose to set up, are they public governments in which natives and non-natives have the right equally to full participation? Or are you trying to set up, have you set up, native governments in which voting rights and the right to participate are restricted to native persons? To what extent have you followed the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act of 1971? To what extent have you adopted or rejected the ANCSA model? And we want to hear from all of you about the important developments going on in all of these places. And we will have, as we go along, the people from Alaska intervening with questions from time to time. Well, just before we ask Shorty O'Neill to begin, Mike Albert from Tununuk. Do you have a question, Mr. Albert? Mike Albert is the IRA president from Tununuk, the head of the tribal government there.
Yes, Judge Berger. Before the actual meeting is going on, I would like to stress my concern. The issues which I have in mind for quite some time, as you probably know, that we have already given our some of our points when the meeting was held at Tununuk. But first of all, I'd like to thank the Judge Berger for giving me this opportunity to say a few words in regards to the land settlement and the sovereignty of the Native people in Alaska. As we all know that the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act was done in 1971. It's been about 12, 13 years right now. And so far, up to now, the Native people in the area of Chalista Corporation have not known, especially the elders, what the Act is or what the language of the Act is. And I think that the people should know the language of the Act, especially under Section 7I of the Act, that I feel that that language should be changed. And I feel that Native people should be trained and be informed what the Act have done and what the Act means. Also, under the sovereignty, I feel as a Native that Native people in Alaska have no accurate record when the Native people started living in Alaska. And talking about sovereignty, that people in the United States, like for instance the big cities down in the United States, those people are not actually the people that have lived down there from their ancestors so far all the way down. And they do have the sovereign power, but I feel that their power is even less than the Native sovereignty power in Alaska, because the Native people in Alaska have lived in Alaska from the time we don't know when. And they have lived in their state from the time being on all the way down to this part of the years. So therefore, the Native people in Alaska, I think, have a more sovereign power than all the rest of the people in the whole world, because they have lived in their state and villages from the time when who knows when. This may not be really understood, but I'm just trying to give some example which hopefully some of you will be able to understand. And I don't like to take all the time for people that have to take the stand. Thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Albert. I should say that Steve Kakwe, the president of the Dene Nation, has now joined us, and we welcome him. Well, I think now what we'll do is ask Shorty O'Neill, and then Alf Isaac Kiskatello, and then Robert Peterson, and then Mark Gordon to tell us about the movement toward land claims in the places that they are most familiar with. We'll just carry on from there and see how we get along. So, Shorty O'Neill, would you please take over?
Yeah, well, thanks for giving us this opportunity to explain our situation. But I think to get a good grasp of it, we have to go back in history a little bit so people understand the present situation. Australia is a country, an island, one of the largest in the world, which is larger than the United States between Canada and Mexico. In that country, there are over 500 completely separate languages spoken by our people. Each language has as many as 14 dialects. But because of the history, our history, we feel that we're one people. In the beginning, when our ancestors came out of the earth and traveled throughout the country, from one end to the other, they had children, left those children in certain places, giving them areas of land, a separate language and a law to follow. And because of that, we believe that we're one people, one nation, and have been since the beginning of time. In 1770, a funny-looking character from England sailed into the Pacific and was obviously lost, because when he charted the South Pacific, he put the Tongan Islands 500 miles north of where they really are. And if you're in that part of the world and you're 500 miles out of your way, you're pretty well lost. But he turned up on our shores in 1770. He was starving and out of water, and our people fed him and gave him water, and he tried to steal Aboriginal women, both him and his men, and we threw him out of the country. He travelled up the east coast of Australia, continually getting food and water from our people, and again getting thrown out because he was taking more liberties than were allowed to him. And finally he came to a little deserted island in the north coast and raised a pretty coloured flag and fired off about 6 muskets and claimed all of Australia for the King of England. We're not quite sure how he done that or how that was acceptable at the time. But before Cook left England, he was given some orders by the King. These were that if he run into native people in this great Southland, the great land to the south, that he should negotiate with them England's right to set up a colony there. If he didn't find anybody, then he was to go ahead and claim the country for the King of England. It was quite obvious both from our history, the oral history handed down from Aboriginal people, and from his logbooks that he did meet up with Aboriginal people, but he never at any stage made any negotiations with us. In 1788, another funny guy from England called Captain Phillip came with a number of boats. Over half of the people on that were the army, the British military, and the rest were convicts, people that Britain didn't want. This guy was also good at giving some orders from the King of England, was that he was to set up a penal settlement on the east coast of Australia, and that he was to have good relations with the natives and not interfere with their day-to-day lifestyle. And like Captain Cook, this fellow wasn't too good at following orders neither, because he started a war with our people. That was the first invasion of our country. The invasion started in a place called Botany Bay around the Sydney region, and within 100 years slowly spread throughout the whole country. The war continued until about 1937, when the last massacres occurred in the north of Australia. But there were still some regions in Australia that the whites never got into, and they were mainly the desert regions around the central west and the central south. And these, they started to go in the late 1940s, when an area of land in the south deserts the size of West Germany was taken over by the British government for a rocket range. So anybody familiar with Australia knows it as Woomera Rocket Range. The people in that region were then rounded up, put into trucks and dispersed throughout the country. Many ended up as far north as Alice Springs, some in Victoria and New South Wales, even some were shifted into Western Australia. In the early 50s, there were a number of the British and Australian governments tested a number of atomic bombs in these southern deserts where the people were moved out. These atomic blasts had affected many of the people far to the north of there. In the early 1960s, the central western deserts were cleaned out because the British were trying to test rockets over the top of their lands. All of these people were put into the concentration camps that are commonly referred today as Aboriginal reserves. So probably the last invasion of our rights, or the last invasion of these people, were about 1964, when they were moved out. Around this time, the majority of Aboriginal people were either in the concentration camps set up throughout in each state in Australia, or were forced to work as slaves for the pastoral industry. In 1963, a group of people in the north of Northern Territory walked off a station and set up their own outstation on their traditional lands. And because of that and many other strikes that Aboriginal people had pulled off, we were finally forced the Australian government in 1967 to hold a national referendum. This referendum was on three major points. First being that should Aboriginal people in Australia have the right to vote? We weren't allowed to vote in this particular referendum. The second thing was whether or not we could be counted in the National Australian Census. Before 1967, every 5 years, every European in Australia was counted. Every 12 months, every horse, cow or sheep, domestic animal was counted in the country. But Aboriginal people never were. We were regarded at a lower level than that. The third issue in the referendum was whether or not the federal government in Australia had the right to make laws on behalf of Aboriginal people. Subsection 27 of Section 51 of the Australian Constitution at that time stated that the Australian government has the right to make laws on the good government on behalf of any people in Australia except Aboriginals. The referendum was won by 89.5% of a white Australian vote. Subsequently, the subsection 27 was changed and the words except Aboriginals were crossed out. For the first time, we were allowed to vote. And for the first time, we could be counted amongst human beings in Australia. In 1968, there was a court case came before the High Industrial Court of Australia, and the judge handed down a decision that Aboriginal people who were forced to work must be paid for that labour. This court case meant that the use of Aboriginal slave labour was outlawed finally. 14 years ago in our country. In 1972, the Aboriginal movement, which was slowly beginning to unite throughout the country, set up a tent embassy outside of Canberra in the Capital Territory of Australia and played a very major role in the elections of 1972, getting a Labor government into power. In fact, the three issues that changed the government in Australia, which was a pretty right-wing government for about 30 years, was the South African apartheid situation and Australia's trade with South Africa, the Vietnam War, and the Aboriginal situation in Australia. After that time, the communities started to really organise to set up many different types of organisations. As I stated before, Aboriginal people believe that we're a sovereign people, we believe that we're a nation of people. And we always also believe that if we're going to be sovereign, then we have to act like a sovereign people. We have to start to take care of our own affairs. The organisations we first set up were to do with health. We wanted to try and overcome our major health problems that we had. There were educational organisations set up. We believe that if we're a sovereign people, then we must have our own education system. We're also quite upset with the fact that our children have to go through an alien education system that has no meaning for us, an education system that is very racist towards our people. We set up legal organizations so that Aboriginal people going through to European courts had some type of legal protection. Other organizations like community co-ops, which gave some employment to Aboriginal people, cooperative housing societies that overcome the bad housing conditions that Aboriginal people have. These organizations have made fairly great strides in the last 12 years. And to give you a picture of what it was like back in 72, I should give you the present statistics for Aboriginal people in Australia. The current Aboriginal unemployment situation is 80% of our people are unemployed. About 95% of the 20% who are employed by Aboriginal run and controlled organizations. Very few people, or a very small minority, work in either the wider community or government departments in Australia. The health statistics for Aboriginal people would make most third world countries look sick. And we're not joking when we talk about that. Leprosy in Australia for Aboriginal people is 3 times higher per head of population than any other country anywhere in the world, or any other minority group anywhere else in the world. The drugs to halt leprosy have been available since 1948, but it becomes very apparent that white Australia isn't making those drugs available to Aboriginal people. The infant death rate is 10 times higher than the white Australians who live in our country. And we can keep on going with things like sugar diabetes, heart diseases. All of these things stem from a forced change of diet and a forced change of lifestyle. The education system was pretty racist towards Aboriginal people. Before 1972, there wasn't one Aboriginal person who had a university degree. And the doors were of the education system, the universities and or the higher education system were only open to us at the change of government in 1972. Today, I think we have 5 lawyers, about 3 anthropologists, and that's about it. Although we have quite a few people who are starting to go through that education system. We could probably go on with those statistics for all day. Just the last one I want to mention is that it's the latest figures on jail populations for minorities has put Aboriginal people way out in the forefront. We are the most jailed people anywhere in the world by a report in 1981. In fact, on some of the reserves in Queensland, the high violent crime rate is estimated at 4 times higher than any of the worst places in New York per head of population. After these types of organizations were set up, many Aboriginal people looked towards the land movement. We decided that the only way we were going to overcome, or the first step to overcoming all of these problems, was to be able to get hold of land. And through many protests, many movements, in 1975, we were successful in setting up land councils in Northern Territory. And the federal government passed a legislation setting up these land councils. In 1976, the Northern Territory Land Right Bill was passed through federal parliament. And immediately, all of the former reserves in Northern Territory and all of the desert lands and the swamp lands were handed back to Aboriginal people. The reasons these were handed back is because the main industry in the Northern Territory is cattle, and we know these white fella are are pretty good people, but they've never been able to work out a way to grow cattle without giving them water. And so they couldn't grow them in the deserts. And they also haven't been able to work out a way to get cattle to swim. So they couldn't put them in the swampy lands or the swampy regions, which were underwater for about 6 months of the year. So these lands were quite easily handed back to the traditional owners. But the other lands in Northern Territory, something like 75% of a state, is very rich pastoral industry. And we've had major struggles to get any of that land back for the traditional owners. Many people have, throughout Australia, particularly mining companies and right-wing politicians, have proclaimed the Northern Territory Land Rights Act as being racist and geared towards Aboriginal people. What they don't realise is that one-third of the state of Northern Territory is owned by absentee owners, people who don't even live in the country, who live here in America or in England or in other parts of Europe. And Aboriginal people have no chance of getting any of that land back under the present legislation. The next step in the land movement was to set up the unincorporated land councils. The first one of these was in North Queensland. It's called the North Queensland Land Council. I was an executive on that organisation for 5 years. The second was in the Northwest Kimberleys region, called the Kimberley Land Council. And then we moved into other parts of Australia and set up New